Well, all right. Everybody get your exam. The average on this one was in the mid-70s, somewhere, like it usually was, although there is some strange variation. Some of you that did poorly in the first one did well on this one, and vice versa. But as a class, it all ended up averaging out somehow. So I'll put the... I don't remember if I've put the answer key up or not yet, but if not, I'll get that up soon so you can check it. And otherwise, I don't have much for other announcements. I have updated your grades in D2L. I did that before class today, so you can go in there and see where you stand presently. Keep in mind, though, that I still have some more lab reports to get back to you, and those are typically boost people's grades a little bit. So, whoops. All right, well, I got some interesting stuff to show you. We're out of hydrogen, so I couldn't do the hydrogen balloons today. We'll get some more hydrogen, and I'll do those for you later. But I got some other good stuff, some decent pyrotechnics for you today, I think you'll like. Anybody have questions about where we're standing? We're doing the Beer's Law Lab today. I believe I got materials lists from everybody. I'm going to double check, and I'll want to clarify a couple of things with some of you today in lab just to make sure we have everything ready for your projects next week. There will be new Mastering Chemistry assignments up this week. I'll probably get them up Wednesday morning, either tomorrow or Wednesday morning. So you'll have at least a couple of weeks to work on the first one from there. Does anybody have anything? Yeah, John.
But we don't have class on Wednesday, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. It's, what is it, Veterans Day?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So, yeah, don't show up here on Wednesday. Yeah, sure. Party in Andy's house.
All right.
Other questions? We ended last time with the relationship between Greek letters lambda and nu. Remember what the lambda was? This one, lambda?
Wavelength.
Okay. And nu is frequency. So wavelength and frequency are related by the speed of light. So just for a little warm-up, let's have you do a quick calculation here. What is the frequency in hertz of a 473 nanometer blue light? Give that a try. Use this equation here. What do nanometers mean? But that's wavelength. What with the unit nanometers? What's that? Yeah, nano is 10 to the minus 9, right? There are 10 to the 9 nanometers in a meter. So don't forget to include that. So take just a second, see if you can punch that out. Anybody need to borrow a calculator? Calculator out of here if you don't. Thank you.
compare with those around you. Make sure, there's a consensus within your region.
I think if you get anything out of this course, it would be something to the effect that you're not allowed to just plug numbers into an equation. Right? All right, it may seem simple enough to rearrange the equation and plug numbers in, but why can't you just plug numbers into an equation? Why can't I do 3.00 times 10 to the 8 divided by 473? So there's one thing I hope I've driven home in here. It's the importance of making sure your units match up. And that's just over years of seeing good students make stupid mistakes with units. So what did somebody do to the 473 first before you plugged it in? Or 73 times 10 to the negative 9. Yeah, that's because there's 10 to the negative 9 meters per 1 nanometer. So 473 times 10 to the negative 9, that's your engineering notation again, isn't it? Right? 4.73 times 10 to the negative 7. I kind of like that engineering notation. It's really
lovely.
It's really handy for units. Maybe us chemists should think twice about our notation. Yeah. So if I have the value on the bottom of that fraction in meters, what do we get for a unit for our answer?
Per second.
Yeah, we get reciprocal seconds, or 1 over second, or per second. Okay? So, what did somebody get? Shout it out. I heard a 6. I like that so far. 6 what? Somebody over to my right, I think it's your turn. You get something over here, any U4?
6.3.
Anybody care to amend that?
6.34.
Times 10 to the 14. Per second, or hertz. Okay. So, this should be a fairly simple calculation. Okay. We're going to go back and forth between nanometers and meters quite a bit. Nanometers visible wavelengths are conventionally given in nanometers, even visible and UV and infrared. Nanometers is just a very common unit used for wavelengths. So the issue is all of the equations we'll be using, it'll need to be in meters. So don't forget about that. It should make sense that our value in meters is a very small number, right? Because nanometers themselves are really tiny, so we'll have a small number of meters. Our frequencies of electromagnetic radiation are huge numbers, 10 to the 14, 16, 18, something like that, because you've got these tiny little waves traveling very, very fast. Of course, there's going to be several of them, right? There's going to be a huge number of them, a little more than several, huge number of them passing one point at any point in time. A ladybug crawling on my desk here. Okay. So, let's talk the electromagnetic spectrum. Any Pink Floyd fans? If I have a beam of white visible light, so from a source that is creating what we would think of as pure white visible light, a prism will separate it into its component colors. And let's think about, we'll dissect that a little bit more. But remember in the microscale density lab, right? You made the little micropicnometers and you put it on the balance, but you measured something else. Remember what the other thing was that you measured?
Refraction.
Yeah, you measured refractive index with a refractometer. And refractive index is a measure of what? Something about light. Yeah, but to what extent light is refracted or bent, its angle changes. So a prism does something like that. There's a prism in that refractometer, in fact, that helps make that measurement. It turns out that triangular shape of a prism makes it so that light is refracted in a certain direction. Any idea, though, why it would separate light out into a rainbow? How come it's not just white light that's refracted? What is white light made of? You guys know that. It's made out of all the component colors. Okay? It's made out of an infinite spectrum of visible colors, okay? All combined together to make white light. So if you look carefully at this prism, what color of light is being refracted the most? Yeah, the violet side of the spectrum, and red is being refracted the least, right? So we're going to make an association with that when we talk about the visible spectrum. So different colors of light, and what is it that determines how we perceive color? What's different about red light and blue light? Wavelength, okay? So different wavelengths of light can be refracted by different amounts going through a prism. That's what ends up separating them out. Okay? We'll come back to that in a little bit. Here's the electromagnetic spectrum. You should have some basic familiarity with this at this point, but essentially visible light is just one tiny little bit. Right? Where are we? Right here. One tiny little sliver of the entire electromagnetic spectrum is comprised of visible light. So we get a little casual when we're talking about electromagnetic radiation. We call it sort of all light. But visible light specifically are the colors of, or the wavelengths of light that cause our eyes to react to it. Okay. Let's specifically look, though, at the relationship here of frequency and wavelength along with energy. So let's start with wavelength. That's the easiest one to visualize, right? Because that's the distance, that's how spread out those little peaks are. Okay? Over here on this side, right, compared to that side right there, that's in meters. Okay? Pretty huge difference in wavelengths, right? Radio waves have the longest wavelengths of any type of electromagnetic radiation. And in fact, AM radio waves have a longer wavelength than FM radio waves. I grew up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, across down by the southeast corner of Minnesota. We could very clearly receive WCCO AM in Sioux Falls, broadcast from up here, but the FM radio stations, you don't get 150 miles or so, something like that. AM radio waves have a pretty long wavelength, right? Here is 10 to the 1, 10 to the 2, so that's 100 meters, right? That's about a football field. That's 1,000 meters. So AM radio waves, their wavelength, for it to get up and down and back up again, it takes, 5 or 6 football fields worth. So can you see how if there are obstacles, right, if there are hills, there are trees, there are buildings, AM radio waves can go around them. Right? Big, huge, long wavelengths, whereas FM radio waves, smaller than 10 meters, but bigger than 1 meter, those can be disrupted by obstacles much more readily. Now, the other thing to consider is the power of that electromagnetic radiation. So different transmitters have different watts of power, which they use, and that can influence their range. But if we had FM signal and AM signal that had the same power to them, the AM signal would be able to travel further across terrain just because of its wavelength. Yeah. That's a satellite radio. What is that? I think that's...
It's like the ultra-high horizon thing.
Would that be almost
close
to the cell phone?
Yeah, I think that's like UHF up in here somewhere.
Isn't the next time you see a satellite beam?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's UHF. I think. I guess I don't know.
It's ultra-high
beam. Yeah, it's something like that. Could be into the microwave too, but the nice thing about that is that it's a satellite. You can much more easily have direct line of sight with it. But if you go into a tunnel, your XM cuts out. So that's because the smaller wavelengths aren't able to turn those corners. So you've got your TV, your FM, your cell phone. We're getting into the microwave radiation there. Microwave radiation, I think of it, you know, a lot more in terms of a lot of times when the TV news is doing a live report, they'll have a truck which extends this big huge aerial into the air and points a dish at the tower to the TV station. That broadcasts microwave radiation. It has more power, but it needs line of sight. That's what I think of when I think of microwaves. What do you guys think of? You think of your, you think of your hot pockets or something like that. It turns out microwave radiation, it's not that it's just such powerful radiation that it's just cooking the food, just like that. It's that the microwave ovens have a special frequency, and the frequency of those waves is just right so that it starts water molecules moving and spinning around and shaking like that. So other things that are not water, right, like paper and cardboard and plastic and stuff, have no impact from microwaves. But so that's why if you put something dry in the microwave, nothing's going to happen. It has to have water in it, or sometimes fat reacts a little bit. But microwave radiation, all it is specially tuned so that it's like a resonance. It's like a resonant frequency that those water molecules can start shaking around and spinning around with. And what do we know? Temperature? What does temperature come from? Yeah, kinetic energy, motion of molecules. So if we can get water molecules moving, it increases the temperature.
So like when you put a fork in the microwave?
If you put a fork in the microwave, metals will conduct types of electromagnetic radiation like that. So it may, anytime you have a frozen meal, it has actually metal inside of the container there, so it heats it evenly. So metal doesn't explode in the microwave, but if it has a point to it, something like a fork, it can sort of conduct and it can all get to that point and it can arc across it or something like that. So your microwave will not instantly explode the moment metal comes inside of it, but it can arc like that.
So something interesting I saw on like a TV show is that if you take a grape and like slice it down the middle so there's just a little disconnect at the bottom, the electrolytes in the grape will actually conduct electricity and start creating fire.
Yeah, you can arc it across. Yeah. That's not surprising. Yeah. Should we take this time to talk about microwave safety? There's actually a problem with microwaving water, but it's pure water. So if you're microwaving distilled water or pure water or something like that, anybody know what the problem is with that?
It explodes, but it doesn't have oil.
Yeah, it has nowhere for the bubbles to form. If it's perfectly pure, if it's in like a glass container, something with no scratches on it, there's nowhere for the bubbles to form, and it'll get superheated. It'll be above the boiling point. So if you jostle it or put a spoon or anything in it, it'll immediately start boiling, and it'll splash up and burn your face off. So it's not usually a problem with tap water, because tap water has enough impurities that bubbles can start to form just amongst all the junk that's floating around it. So they actually did that on MythBusters. It actually works, and people actually have gotten hurt by trying to microwave pure water like that. You will, however, not get cancer by standing too close to the microwave oven. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because the metal in the pacemakers can conduct the... anytime there's electromagnetic radiation perpendicular to metal, an electrical current flows through it. So.
The frequencies are like 0.8 or 0.1.
Mm-hmm. But if we think about this, your microwave oven, on the door of it, it's not just a regular window, right? You looked carefully at it. What's in the window of a microwave oven? Yeah, there's something. But what shape is it? What's it look like? Yeah, it's like a grid. It's tiny little holes, right? So it's made of metal. It has tiny little holes. Let's look at the wavelength of microwaves. So that's a decimeter, that's a centimeter, that's a millimeter. So microwaves are, I think, half a decimeter, right? 6-7 centimeters usually is the wavelength of them. Why is it safe to look through those holes into a microwave oven? Yeah, you've got waves that have this kind of wavelength. You would need holes that are like that big in order for microwaves to get through them. So no problem standing next to a microwave. Even if you put your hand in the microwave, it wouldn't give you cancer or anything, but the water in your cells would start to heat up and boil, and you'd get burned or something. They're all kind of, and it's surprising how, 60 years after microwaves have been around, there are still people afraid of microwaving things because of the cancer. Don't recommend that either. But as long as we're doing microwave safety, there is a problem with microwaving things in plastic containers that are not specifically made for food. Yeah, things that are made of plastic have plasticizers in them that keep them so you can bendable, right? So they're not brittle and they won't break. So if you're using something that's not meant for food, you can get plasticizers that leach into your food, and things like phthalates, if you've ever heard of those. And then the other thing, bisphenol A and those polycarbonates that have been gone off the market recently. Bisphenol A is something that can be leached out of plastic that way. But if it's something that is meant for food, right, if it's those Ziploc Tupperware kind of containers, no plasticizers, no phthalates, right, that's what they're designed for. So we had lowest energy, and over here we have highest energy. So which one of these two, frequency or wavelength, which of those is energy proportional to? Frequency. Okay? Energy is proportional to frequency. The more waves you have hitting a point per second, the more energy is able to be transferred. Okay? It has what kind of relationship with wavelength, though? Yeah, it's inversely, right? So longest wavelength is the lowest energy. So I'm increasing energy as I'm getting shorter and shorter wavelengths, okay? But we're increasing the frequency as well. So next is infrared. Infrared acts pretty much just like visible light, except you can't see it. That's that's how I like to think of infrared, because the remote control on your TV or anything like this, there's a little LED in here that emits infrared light. This could just as well be could be a little red LED that blinks, and there's a little detector on your TV that detects the rate of blinking from that. But just so it's not annoying to look at, it's infrared. Okay? It's just like visible, no different. Bluetooth is another one of these radiation here. It's all the cell phone and the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth and all those things are sort of in the low energy microwave region in there, the cordless phones and all that stuff. It turns out that things that are hot give off more infrared radiation. That's just an extreme of the fact that if you take something metal and you put it in a fire or something, once it gets hot enough, it'll start to glow, right? It just turns out that infrared is emitted well before visible starts to be emitted. So that's why if there's a camera that's sensitive to infrared, and if it's on a helicopter or something, then the police can catch the crook who's trying to hide in the cornfield at night or something like that. So here's visible light. What color has the highest energy, red or violet?
Violet.
Right? There's the low energy side. Here's the high energy side. Violet has what wavelength? Longest or shortest wavelength of visible? Shortest wavelength of visible, right? Down to 400 nanometers, Red is at 750, which has the higher frequency. There's frequency up here. Yeah, violet has high frequency, high energy, shorter wavelength. Right. Red is the opposite. That's going to be important to us a little bit later on. Okay. Past violet is ultraviolet. How does ultraviolet's energy compare to visible light?
Higher
in energy, right? Because it's shorter in wavelength. It has more waves hitting a point at any certain point in time. That becomes important because once we get into ultraviolet, we start to come upon electromagnetic radiation that actually is harmful. So where does harmful ultraviolet radiation come from? A lot of times, yeah. The sun emits a large amount of infrared, visible, and ultraviolet radiation. Okay? Nobody cares much about the infrared radiation, although that can give rise to some radiant heat and greenhouse effect and things like that. But ultraviolet radiation has higher energy, so it can actually start to cause troubles within your skin cells. For instance, it has enough energy to start to actually disrupt DNA and things like that, things that cause cancer. So UVA, UVB, UVC, those are all different ranges of wavelengths within the ultraviolet. There's long wave and short wave, too. That's another way of classifying it. What has higher energy, long wave or short wave? Well, that's just what we call two types of ultraviolet radiation. What do you suppose that refers to? Long wave and short wave. Yeah, there's the wavelength, right? You all heard of short wave radio, right? That's radio that's high powered up in here. Okay? Short wave ultraviolet is high energy ultraviolet light that's used in sanitizing lights. You know, when you put your goggles in the cabinet, there's a shortwave ultraviolet light that kills the germs in there. Longwave ultraviolet radiation is given off by black lights, so it causes certain pigments to fluoresce, to give off light when they've been hit with radiation. So, your fabric detergent, right, your laundry detergent, it has a dye in it that glows when it's exposed to ultraviolet light. Why would they do something like that? Pretty much every laundry detergent, except the one that says no dyes or something, but almost every laundry detergent, why would they do something like that? Why would the Tide people think that's a good idea? So you know you're using it? You can hold up a black light and see who's washed their clothes or something. If you go outside and you're wearing something white, okay, and not only is it reflecting light, but it's also glowing a little bit, right? That's a good thing. It makes it seem brighter, right? So it's what, without that, you know, we've gotten so used to seeing white things that are so white that they reflect all their light and they glow a little bit. Okay? Without that, people would think that their whites weren't getting bright enough. Right. So, but that's why if you're at a party and there's a black light, your socks, if you're wearing white socks, they're glowing purple under the black light. So, X-ray, higher energy yet. Okay. When you break your arm, you get an X-ray because X-rays have high enough energy so that they can penetrate to your flesh, but they can't get through bones, right? So if you have an X-ray radiation source and film on the other side, it sees the X-rays that got through, but the bones interrupt it, so they can see where your bones are broken. Okay? But again, X-ray has higher energy. You don't want to get too many X-rays, okay? Especially in your important parts, because again, it has even more power to cause disruptions and so on. So gamma radiation is the highest energy electromagnetic radiation, there is. This is from the, if an atomic bomb were to go off, for instance, and if we were not to be destroyed immediately by just the shockwave of it, we would probably end up getting radiation poisoning or cancer, you know, lymphoma, something like that, because of the gamma radiation that's given off by nuclear reactions. So gamma radiation has enough energy to break chemical bonds, okay? Carbon and hydrogen that were bonded together, it pulls them apart. So you end up with radicals that can combine with other things, and so very harmful that way. Okay? Yes? Yeah. I think you get eye strain if there's too much contrast between what you're looking at and the background, but I don't think there's any kind of radiation or cancer or anything like that. So it's more of a ergonomic issue than anything. So, all right. Any other myths we care to bust here? I'll call it Mythbusters. Maybe the Discovery Channel would be interested. All right. So I mentioned last time that light has two types of properties. It has wave-like properties and particle-like properties. And this is so hard for us to imagine that one thing has two properties, because in our world, something is, you know, what we see of it, right? This, you know, the chairs are red, it's solid, you know, it is what it is. It can't be two things, but as soon as we get down to smaller than the size of an atom, as soon as quantum mechanics takes over, the world, it's a different world than the one that we are able to perceive. Okay? Things can be in two places at once. Things can disappear over here and then instantly reappear over there. Something can have multiple properties at the same time. So a way to think of this, though, is that the two types of properties are just our best way of perceiving what it actually is that light is made up of. Okay? It's waves can't fully explain it. Particles can't fully explain it. Whatever it is, the closest we can get is to say that it has wave-like properties and particle-like properties, depending on the experiments that we're doing. So here's a classic experiment. If I take a light source, works really well with a laser beam, something like that, and I shine that light through two slits, so a big cardboard panel or something with two really skinny little slits in it, what you'll actually see on the other side is not just two beams of light, like you would expect, but an interference pattern. Okay. You'll see something like this. It'll look like zebra stripes or something like that, where there's dark parts and light parts. Okay. Dark light, dark light, dark light, dark light. Okay. And that's because of the wave nature of light, where these two beams in some places can be canceling each other out. Yeah, like that. Where the peak of one wave is right at the valley of another wave, so those two cancel each other out. Okay. And there's no light that gets through here, or they can reinforce each other where the peak of this wave is matched up with the peak of that wave. So you would actually see a similar effect to this if you had in a bathtub or a pond or something like that, if you had a panel with two little slits in it and you drop something in the pool, you drop something in the water and it makes waves that come out from that. The waves that make it through the little slits will in some places reinforce each other and in some places cancel each other out. So waves are easy for us to understand when it's with water because we've seen that. But light has those exact same properties, really. So this is an actual experiment that can prove that light has wave-like properties to it. But that's not the whole story, because there's also the photoelectric effect. And this is just a nice little, we'll talk more about this on the next page, but this is just a nice figure that illustrates it. Photoelectric effect was actually some of Albert Einstein's earliest work. Long before he started doing relativity and space-time and all that, he was interested in the relationship between light and energy, right? Light and electricity. So what you can get, if you have a certain metal, certain types of metal, when light strikes them, they can emit electrons. So this is the setup. It's in an evacuated glass tube here. Here's the metal on the back there. If light strikes it, those electrons can be picked up by a conductive rod that's over here. And you can actually register an electric current that's flowing through that because of the conduction of light. Semiconductors, things like germanium, tend to work really well for that. There are compounds now that take advantage of this effect in an electric eye type thing, or in the sensor for a digital camera or something like that. Okay? It's an effect that's taken advantage of. But what does that have to do with waves and particles? Turns out that electrons are ejected from the metal only after a certain frequency of light hits it. So you can actually, if you have a light source and you can change the frequency, so say you just got a filter in front of a lamp or something, so you're shining red, blue, you know, red, then orange, then yellow, then blue. Once you hit a certain frequency, then electrons will start to be ejected. But below that certain threshold level, there's nothing. So Einstein actually figured out that if one photon of light, right, one little individual particle of light strikes the surface and it has a sufficient frequency to it, then one electron will leave from the metal. So you can do that with just very small amounts of light, with a very sensitive current meter. It's not completely continuous. Okay? So that photon, that individual particle of light, or an individual packet of light, that photon has to have a sufficient energy to it before an electron is ejected. And that's not something necessarily that can be explained just using the wave property of light. Here, light is actually acting like a particle that strikes the surface and knocks an electron away. So, but it has to have enough energy, otherwise it can't do it. So this equation right here, this defines the particle nature of light. Let's call this the particle equation. Okay. E equals h nu. E is the energy of one photon. So again, we're talking about that theoretical particle of light. H is a certain constant. Okay. We're not so concerned with the number. That's just what it is to make our calculations work out. But look at the units. Joules, seconds. Joules times seconds. Okay. Why would it be joules, seconds? What unit does E have to have? Joules? What unit does nu have? Seconds? Close. Per second. Yeah, reciprocal second. Right? So, again, let's make sure those we get those units right. Joules, seconds. Per second. Okay? So that is the relationship. And what did I say that energy and frequency, what kind of relationship did those have? Back up a little bit here, right? Here we were highest energy over here in gamma rays, right? Way over on that side. High energy means what frequency? High frequency. So what relationship is that? Directly proportional. Is that consistent with our equation here? Are energy and frequency directly proportional? Yeah. H, Planck's constant, is the proportionality constant between energy and frequency. So we have two equations. This was the particle equation, equals H nu. What does that mean I should call C equals lambda nu? Lambda was what? wavelength. So if this is an equation talking about light as a particle, then that's an equation. Yeah, that's the wave equation. That defines, so we've got light's particle-like properties, we have light's wave-like properties in those two equations. What's the one common variable in those two equations? Yeah, frequency is common between those. So C equals lambda nu. If I rearrange, nu equals C over lambda. Substituting that in up above, E equals what? H C over lambda. This is a combined particle wave. Equation. From that equation, you can take light of a certain wavelength, okay? You can take a wave-like property and get energy of one photon of that light. Okay? So that equation bridges those two types of properties. So here's one for you to work on. How much energy is in one photon of blue light with a wavelength of 473 nanometers? I'll give you just a second. Remember what C is? 3.00. That's 10 to the 8 meters per second. Here we go. So plug it on in, make sure your units match up. So what did you get? Big answer? Small answer? Small answer? Why should this be a small answer? Why? Yeah, look at our question here. How much energy is in one photon? One photon isn't a lot. One photon is a tiny massless particle of light. Okay? If you want to use engineering notation here, if you want to do 473 times 10 to the minus 9, that works. Actually, one less place to make a mistake. What unit are you left with? Yeah, because per seconds cancels, meters cancel. You guys in front get something? Do I have a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Yeah. tiny, tiny amount of energy is conveyed by a single photon of light. So, in other words, to have a heating lamp at the breakfast buffet that's keeping the prime rib warm at the end, that lamp has to be giving off a lot of photons, lots and lots and lots and lots of photons, in order to be providing enough joules of energy to keep something heated up. Right? So the more light is given off, the more photons. Okay? So the more powerful a light bulb is, the more photons are given off by it. Okay? So we're going to come back to that in a moment. Got something to show you, though. It's called a gas lamp. Here, I'll set it on the floor. Turn the lights out for a moment. All right. That's not anything yet, but if I put inside of this thing, this is just a power supply. So all that does is apply an electric current across to electrodes in there. If I put something like a lamp in there that contains neon, nothing special about this. It's just a glass tube that's been evacuated, and then neon was pumped into it, and then it just has two conducting electrodes inside of there. So nothing special. Break all the gas lamps. Well, that's not neon. That is... it's still cool. It's argon. It's purple. Let me see if I can find the neon. Somebody didn't put these back in the right... Come on, Dan. Well, let's see which one was in the argon. Maybe that's where the neon is. No, that's not neon. That's hydrogen. Oh, well. What I want us to do
gratings, so they do the same thing that prism would do.
Hold it straight up to your eye, and I'll turn the projector off as soon as I get them passed up.
Hold it right up against your eye, and put the gas on. In the lamp. And adjust it so that you see something to the left and to the right. Okay.
Projector's too bright, so you guys can't see anything yet. Turn the projector off, though. Hold it straight up to your eye. And then do you see a little rainbow kind of thing going off to the left and one off to the right?
Yes.
Of it? How would you describe that? Is it a smooth rainbow?
No.
It's all kinds of little breaks in it. Let me put a different one in. This one is... not sure what that one was. I'm not labeled anymore. Yeah, that one's fainter. So at least it has a label. It was in the hydrogen box, but... ooh, it's oxygen. It's almost white. I'm going to have to turn the... projector back on here, because I really do want to... Well, I made it worse. There we go. I might need to have a word with Dan about putting these back in the right... Anyway. Well, here's another unlabeled one.
Oh. We only use one, so I don't understand how we got it that screwed.
That one's a little better. What do you see with that one? Can you count about how many lines you see with that one?
Three.
There's actually four, but the fourth one is really faint.
Oh, I see orange.
Yeah,
what?
Orange, yellow, green.
Like over here.
So, I'm pretty sure this one is hydrogen. If not, it's close enough to what hydrogen is. So you saw we had different elements in there, and if we look through these little prisms, the light they're given off is composed differently. So none of them gives a smooth rainbow kind of spectrum. They all give these sort of interrupted, only certain colors that are given off. While I'm at it, I'll cut the lights off. And keep those prisms. And don't forget which way you are holding them. Okay, we're going to do something similar. We have a torch. In these bottles are solutions of various salts. So here's some copper chloride. Too much, it turns into a flamethrower, so. Yeah, but it's a little harder to see, but especially since it's not a thin slit. But if we were to have a thin slit of that, you would see those colors broken up into only particular colors, the same way that the gas lamps do. First one was copper, it gave that green flame. This is strontium chloride. And this red flame. There we go. Potassium. Kind of purple. And sodium. Orange. I managed to do that without setting the place on fire. So that's always good. Not sure how that happened, but... Alright.
Let's back up.
Well, that's not what I wanted. There we go.
Oh, that's bright.
All right. So, the traditional celebration in the middle of summer takes advantage of these same sort of properties to different substances. When they burn or when they're when electricity is applied to them, they give off different colors, different wavelengths of light. So the gas lamp glowed when we applied the high voltage. We sent it through a prism, okay, but only certain specific colors were given off. Oh, I think that one that had only four was helium, don't you? That looks about right. There was a red, kind of a yellow, and a couple blue ones, something like that. Okay. It was one of those. Eventually we'll reorganize those maybe, but contrast that with a white light spectrum. Okay? If it's light that's given off by a glowing filament, by a piece of metal that's glowing, or the sun, for instance, where it's very dense and there's lots of kind of different interactions that are happening, then it gives off this continuous infinite spectrum. But if it's a pure gas sample or a solution like that, it gives off only these specific colors of light. I couldn't find the neon, but neon glows with a bright reddish-orange kind of color. The things we think of as neon lamps, some of them have neon, but a lot of them have other gases in there to make the green and the purple and the white and the yellow. So the reason that's important is because these different colors given off by different substances, that actually was the very first evidence towards behavior of electrons inside of atoms and molecules. If we take a look at what happens here, this is what Niels Bohr came up with, and he only dealt with the hydrogen atom. So what Bohr said was that electrons in the hydrogen atom, they occupy only certain energy levels. So those electrons are only allowed to have certain energies and nothing in between. Okay? The energy of the electron determines which of these energy levels it occupies. So the lowest energy electron, right, might be down here. If that electron were to be fed energy, it would become excited and it would hop to one of these higher energy levels. Okay. Electrons absorb energy to be promoted. If an electron drops to a lower energy level, it gives off energy. So if we think back to our gas lamps, we were providing energy into those electrons because I plugged it into the wall. Okay. Our flame tests, the flame was providing energy into the electrons in those substances. Okay. So they were pulling energy in and therefore jumping up to a high energy level, but they don't stay at these high energy levels very long. If it's high energy, it's unstable. It wants to drop back down. But the way it drops back down determines how much energy is given off. So I asked you before, which has higher energy, violet or red? From this picture here, you ought to be able to see, right? What does violet or red have higher energy? Violet does. If this electron drops from the fifth energy level all the way down to the second energy level, it gives off a large amount of energy. So it will give off photons that have more energy to them. Okay? We saw in that combined equation that larger energy can mean a smaller wavelength. Okay? Energy and wavelength are inversely proportional that way. So the biggest leap down gives off a higher energy color of light. Small leaps, like this one, just 3 to 2, will give off something like red, something that's on the lower energy side of the visible spectrum. So, because of the way that the electrons are arranged in all these different substances I had here, there are only certain combinations of jumps that can happen to give off only certain colors of light. The more possibilities there are, the more colors of light will be given off, and the more of those little bands you'll see coming off in your prisms. Okay? But if it's a simple atom, something just like hydrogen that has only one electron to deal with right here, there are really only these ones that give off visible colors of light. Okay? Bigger jumps can give off ultraviolet, okay, even higher energy. If I went from 2 to 1, that would be an even smaller jump. That would be over in infrared over there. So these, it's really about these, maybe one other you could sort of see over in violet there. But this was actually the first evidence towards how electrons themselves can behave. And this is that strange behavior I was talking about. This electron doesn't just fall down to here. It starts right here, and then it reappears down there. Okay? It disappears from one place while it simultaneously reappears in the other place. Okay? It leaps between those energy levels. There's nothing in between. Yeah. So the difference between those energy levels actually tells you the amount of energy that's given off in those photons. So turns out that electrons themselves have a wave-particle duality. We talked about how light can behave as particles and waves, but so can electrons. And we'll just talk about this for a little bit before we go. This first one is expected behavior for particles. So if I have an actual stream of particles that's flying through these slits, we would expect to see two bands that have appeared on the other side of it. But in fact, what we get is an interference pattern, a lot like we would get just by shining light through thin slits, like that. Okay? But this is the really weird thing. I still don't get this. This is actual electron behavior. If all we're doing is shining light through, we get an interference pattern. But what you can actually do, you can shine a very high energy laser beam, okay, across there, and that should be able to detect any electrons that are flying through it. Okay? Because if an electron gets enough energy, it can sort of light up, it can give off energy. So this experiment right here, this would only work if these electrons acted as particles. So as soon as we turn this laser beam on going across there that should be able to detect particles, well, look at what happens over here. What kind of behavior is this like? Is this like waves or particles? This is like particles. So all we had to do, it's so strange, all we had to do was do an experiment where we would be able to detect particles here, and then electrons start behaving like particles. Okay? If we have no way of detecting particles, they'll act as waves. And don't feel bad if that doesn't make sense. That makes no sense to me at all. That makes no sense to the people that discovered this. It's weird. We don't have the capability to actually understand why that is. The best we can do is say that under certain experiments, light or electrons behave as waves. Under other experiments, they behave as electrons. So in reality, they're really neither. In reality, it's something that we don't really quite understand or have a way to explain. But it just sort of manifests itself in these two sort of different kind of strange ways. We tend to think of electrons as particles, right? We've talked about gaining electrons and losing electrons being transferred from one place to another. But when it's an electron just inside of an atom, it's actually its wave-like properties that are important to it. Think of how, you know, these electrons can only have these certain amount of energies. If an electron was, instead of a particle, it was like a wave of energy that was going around, there are only certain numbers of full waves that can make it around a circle, right? If you think of if you've got a jump rope tied to the wall over there, you can have it make one big wave, or if you go faster, you can make two waves in it, or three waves in it, or four waves, but you can't make 2.5 waves, or 4 3/8 waves, or something like that. So this behavior of these exact numbers, these exact different amounts of energy, comes directly from electrons behaving as waves. So it's sort of like standing waves, where if there's higher energy, there's more waves that are going, sort of a shorter wavelength to those electrons that way. So, just before we go here, and we'll talk a little bit more about this weird stuff, and then we'll be done. They're complementary properties, though. Waves and particle natures are complementary, meaning the more I know about one, the less I know about the other. Okay? And that explains why that last experiment that we had worked the way it did. If we were to see a particle, an electron as a particle, then we don't know anything about its wave-like properties, and it looks like particles that are coming through. Okay? So that's what the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is. The position of an electron is related to its particle nature. Okay? If we have a particle, we should be able to see where it is. That's what that laser beam going through the light source would do. It would be able to show us there's a particle right there. Okay? The momentum of an electron has more to do with its wave nature, and that's a more complicated idea to get across, but the momentum of tiny subatomic particles like that has more to do with how it behaves as a wave than it actually does as a particle, because they're essentially massless particles. You can't really be talking about the momentum of a massless particle. That doesn't work so well. So, but position and momentum, those are the things that give us insights into the particle nature and the wave nature of electrons, but I cannot know those both precisely at the same time. So this strange equation is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. We do not need to do any math with this, but all you need to do is just to be able to identify these parts of it. Delta X, uncertainty in position. Okay. Mass times change in velocity. What's that? Momentum, right? If it's a delta V there, that's uncertainty in momentum. Okay. Those two uncertainties multiplied must be greater than a certain constant, and strangely enough, there's that same H that was used before as the relationship between energy and frequency. So Heisenberg was probably a bit surprised when he came up with something like this. But essentially, if one of these is very, very small, okay, if uncertainty is small, then we know a lot about it. The other one has to be huge. Okay? We know nothing about it, essentially. So it's impossible for us to know. If I were to know the position of an electron, okay, if I were to, in that laser beam shining across, if I were to see, hey, there's an electron right there, I would have no idea where it's going. Okay? If I know its position, I don't know its momentum. If I know its momentum, if I know the general direction the electrons are going, I know nothing about any individual electron within there. So that's the really strange thing about that. But if I've been talking all about what we don't know, okay, so what we do know. Quantum mechanics lets us calculate probability of electrons behaving in a certain way. Okay? So we'll go through these more next time, but what we can say is that there's a high probability of electrons in this area and in that area. There's no probability, hardly, of electrons within this area or something like that. So without talking about any one certain electron and without talking about where they're going, really, we can say with probabilities where those electrons are. Okay? So that's where we'll end. We'll meet you in lab in 15 minutes.